Okay, folks, welcome to the latest edition, the latest chapter, the latest rip-roaring adventures from life on Planet Porky, with, of course, myself, the Porkmeister, Michael Parry, and the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, how are you doing today?
Oh, fighting fit, Michael. You?
Yeah, not bad. I tell you what, I've been suffering gales in the last sort of 12 hours. I've had to batten down all the garden furniture. All my daffodils have been blown to smithereens, although I did manage to get a crop of them inside yesterday, which are now in a beautiful vase right in front of me in my office here. I do love daffodils. I've told you that before. So, and I'm doing a bit of television this week, so that'll be a backdrop for my home studio here at Porkmeister Towers.
How lovely. What about the gnomes? Did they take flight?
Well, no, they were protected before I realised the wind was coming, so they always get put away before anything happens. Anyway, look, there's only one story in town for you and I today and, you know, for the past couple of days and probably for the next few days, if not weeks, and that is, of course, the enormous drama surrounding the departure from Good Morning Britain of our mutual Fleet Street pal and now really TV superstar Piers Morgan. How did you react to the sudden, you know, massive impact of the bust up on Tuesday morning, followed by Piers quitting?
Well, I laughed my head off. It was obviously staged. It was a quintessential masterstroke, of course.
Yeah.
Piers, you know what Piers is like. You've known him as long as I have.
Yeah.
He gets bored very easily. He's been at Good Morning Britain now 5-6 years. He's done everything that he can do there. So he's just treading water until the right thing comes along. The biggest story of the decade happens, which is Oprah Winfrey's interview with the Duke and Duchess of wherever they live.
Yeah.
And he perceives an opportunity to jump on this bandwagon to reap the rewards of global publicity, because his name is now synonymous with Meghan's.
Yes.
The whole world knows who he is, if they didn't before. And he's used that opportunity to maximise his own profile by storming off the show because somebody has a go at him. He obviously hasn't told his co-presenters he's going to do this. But I can just see the plan cooking away in his head.
Well,
and he's seized the opportunity. And good luck to the guy. I think he's so clever.
Oh, well, I think he's a very clever man. You know, my famous refrain is always, I used to be Piers Morgan's boss. When I was the executive editor at The Sun, Piers was doing the Bizarre column. But, I mean, he rapidly overtook me at a speed of light before I knew it. He was the editor of the News of the World. He got invited over to America and walked on a beach with Mr. Murdoch, who owns the News of the World and owns many other things in the media village. And at the age of 28, I think it was, or 29, he was made the national news editor of the biggest selling paper in Europe. A year later,
at which point he hired me.
Oh, right, of course. Yeah,
I very clearly remember getting the call to come in and see him.
Yeah.
And I was working for You magazine at the time, doing showbiz interviews. And he asked me in to see him. He was terribly charming. And we had a really nice morning. He said to me, all those great interviews that you do on You magazine, I want you to come to the News of the World and do them here. I said, Piers, come on. You know, none of those people are going to talk to the News of the World.
Yeah.
So he made me an offer and he said, for this much, they will. Yeah. And I said, Piers, they're not going to talk to the News of the World. So he said, what if I double it?
Yeah.
So he doubled the offer he'd made me 2 seconds ago.
Right.
And of course, you know, you don't turn that down.
No,
do you?
Of course not. No.
So we had a good run doing that until he went to the Daily Mirror.
Yeah, I know. It was very short-lived, wasn't it? And I think probably, you know, there may be a regret or two around in the media world that he didn't immediately go to The Sun. But that's another story. I mean, his career
is
blossomed.
If you think about it, those daily editorships, and that's what every editor wants.
Yes.
There are very few of those jobs.
Exactly.
Being the editor of a daily newspaper, which is the holy grail if you are in journalism.
Sure.
So you say it was short-lived, but actually, no, he was at the News of the World about 3 years.
Yeah.
And then up comes the opportunity to edit a daily. You don't turn that down. So off he went.
No, but you'd have thought, I'd have thought the Murdoch organisation would have said, no, don't go to the Mirror. We'll work something out here.
Well, there wasn't a daily for him to go to at that point.
Well, there was The Sun. I mean, you know.
Yeah,
I know.
Well, you know.
would have meant somebody else stepping down, obviously. But anyway, look.
That somebody else had a watertight contract. Yeah, I completely see that. But shows you his attention span. Sort of 3 to 5 years, he's getting restless. He wants to move on and do something else. And frankly, everything he's ever set out to do, he's achieved with Robson.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I'll tell you a story about him, which is very much shows him in a great light. So when he left the Sun to go to the News of the World, it coincided with the editor of the day, the man Mackenzie, of which we do not speak anymore, and leaving and being shuffled off to Sky. And Stuart Higgins, who was the deputy, then stepped up to become editor. And Stu and I are still friends, have been for about 35 years. But Stuart wanted to bring particular people into the senior roles. And so he's told me he was going to let me go. And it was just one of those things in Fleet Street, you know what I mean? I said, he had somebody else he'd worked with for years. He wanted to bring into that particular role, didn't see where I could fit in anywhere else. I said, that's fine, you know, no problem at all. We parted on good terms and we have been good friends ever since. But after I left, about 2 days later, I received a letter, and it had been announced that Piers was going then to the News of the World. And I was astonished, and I'd sent him a quick note before I left, handwritten, you know, sent to him saying, you know, congratulations, Piers, well done. You'll do a brilliant job. I know you will. Start of a glorious career. Piers sent me a handwritten letter back to my home address, thanking me for his note, telling me how wonderful it had been to work with me and wishing me the very best for the future. And I remember the last paragraph saying, I'm only sorry that my good fortune has contrasted with your bad fortune. I'm sure we'll work again together one day. And I just thought it was so kind.
Yeah, no, I had a similar experience, believe it or not, when my youngest daughter was born in April 1999.
Yeah.
I received a handwritten letter from Piers saying, "Dear Leslie Ann, congratulations on the birth of your beautiful daughter. I hope she grows up to be as nice as you."
Yeah, lovely.
So
anyway,
sweet. You know, but he's got a very sweet side, Piers.
Oh, yes, he has, definitely. And he's compassionate and he looks after people. You know, on his GMB show, there was this poor little girl who got sepsis and lost all her limbs. I don't know if you used to see. She used to come on and she was just nightmare. A little bundle of fun. And she'd run around on her little stumpy legs and that kind of stuff, you know. And you could see the sheer joy in Piers' eyes twinkling when he saw how, you know, much joy he was bringing to this little girl's world on the TV set, you know.
Yeah, I know. Do you know, I've had kind of a row with my mother about Piers because she cannot stand him. Yeah. And her story is, I've always put GMB on in the mornings just so I can turn it off because they know that I've turned it off because I don't want to watch him.
Yeah.
And she rang me up a couple of days ago and said, "What do you think?" She said, "Piers Morgan, how disgraceful. He's even walking down the road with his little girl and she's being in all the pictures."
Yes.
I said, "Mom, he was probably walking her to school, which is something he's not been able to do for the last 5-6 years.
Mm-hmm. No,
I cannot see why that is a problem. He's taking advantage of the fact that he is able, right at this point, to take his child to school. Yeah. She looks like a really nice little girl as well.
She is. I mean, Piers is now 55, 56. Little girl's 9, I think. So, you know, it's fatherhood in his second generation of being a parent, so to speak. And he was walking her to school. And the other interesting thing is, because he's so anti-woke, he didn't make the demand that most celebs make, "Do not picture my children. You must pixelate her face out of the pictures." He was just happily walking down the road with his daughter and didn't care who saw him.
Because he doesn't see himself as a celebrity. He always sees himself as a journalist.
Yeah, I think you're right.
He's on our side, which is why he always takes our calls. It's why he answers our emails.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's why he rocks up to a journalist's funeral and comes to the pub afterwards, whatever else. He's never let all that celebrity that he does have, and rightly so, he's never let it go to his head.
Yeah. Just one final story, and then we must move on, because although we're fascinated by Piers, and clearly the rest of the country is fascinated by him, there are other things we must talk about on Planet Porky. But you will probably have read Alison Bischoff. Bischoff.
Yeah.
What's her name?
Alison Bischoff. Alison Bischoff. Daily Mail.
Yeah, I used to call her Bish Bosh, and I offered her a job in radio once as a celebrity commentator, but she didn't take it. But anyway, that's beside the by. So I read her piece of song about Piers, and for the first time, You will have known this, but I didn't. She details the meeting between Piers and Meghan Markle. And when Meghan Markle was an unheard of in this country, but she had, you know, the TV show in America, was it called Steps, was it?
Suits.
Yeah. But she landed in this country, wanted to make an impact, and somehow got a message to Piers, who I'm not sure what he was doing then. I don't think he was on GMB. I think, you know, he was doing Piers interviews and he was doing stuff with Simon Cowell and all that. And
yeah, he was doing The X Factor.
Oh, right. Okay.
No. It was Britain's Got Talent. That's the one.
Got Talent.
Doing.
That's it. Yeah.
Britain's Got Talent, and also Piers Morgan's Life Stories.
That's it. So anyway, they meet at his local pub in Kensington, and they're sitting under the baskets of flowers. And he said she was delightful company, very beautiful, and all that. And she was asking for an introduction to TV and all that kind of stuff. And she went from there with Piers, jumped into a taxi, went into Soho, met a group of friends who the following night introduced her to Prince Harry. That was the start of the Meghan and Harry romance. And from the moment that she hooked up with Harry, she no longer bothered taking calls from Piers or trying to contact him. And some say that Piers has taken that, you know, as a snub when he tried to help her, and all the rest of it is revenge, which I frankly do not believe, because we all have to deal with those sort of situations in our business.
Yeah, I could see why he'd be fed up about it, but it was just timing. It's one of those things.
Yeah.
You meet a prince of the realm, suddenly you are not pursuing former newspaper editors or TV presenters, yeah, or that kind of thing, because sure, suddenly the game has really changed,
yeah,
so dramatically that you've got to, instead of running towards the media, you've, yes, suddenly got to backpedal very, yeah, fast.
Yeah.
And no, she would have been told that by, yes, Harry, by palace officials, by,
indeed,
whoever.
No, indeed. You're absolutely right. Once you get into the royal circle, everything else, boomf, the shutter comes down, does it not? Anyway, so there you go. All very interesting. Ms. Jones, let me talk to you briefly about the World Trade Center, which came down, of course, and, you know, one of the greatest acts of terrorism in history. I read obituaries in the heavy papers because I like to read about war heroes, and, you know, you get rock stars because it's that generation now where all these rock stars in their 70s are kind of, you know, dying. And I came across an amazing obituary of a guy who was the engineer and architect of the World Trade Center. OK, and I'm trying to find his name here now, and I will.
It's Leslie Robertson.
Well done. Thank you very much indeed. And I have to say it was riveting because he built the World Trade Center. He said it was unassailable and could even stand the impact of a Boeing 747 jumbo jet hitting either of the towers. And yet when planes of lesser magnitude hit both the towers, they collapsed. And he says he never had another night's sleep for the rest of his life had he failed the people of America.
It's very interesting because the investigation that they carried out,
yeah,
on what was left of the World Trade Center after the terrorist attack,
yes,
did actually find that the towers withstood the impact of the plane,
yeah,
with enough time to allow thousands of occupants to escape.
17,000. 17,000 got out.
So
yeah,
in fact, it did do its job. And his firm did go on to do further structural engineering in that whole World Trade Center,
yeah,
zone of New York. So, yeah, I don't think he should have beaten himself up that much about it, because actually many, many lives were saved because of his expertise.
Yeah, no, you're right. What they hadn't accounted for, because it wasn't an engineering problem, was the extreme heat that was generated by the kerosene, i.e. the aviation fuel, in the two planes. Because they might have anticipated a plane hitting those towers coming from across the Atlantic, if you see what I mean, when the fuel tanks would have been empty. But these planes had been hijacked locally and the fuel tanks were full. So the kerosene soaked into the building, burnt at 500 degrees centigrade, and melted the metal structure that was keeping the towers up. And that's why they collapsed.
Yeah, it's very sad.
It's terribly sad. And I think
we all remember that the news footage of the morning it happened.
We certainly do. We certainly do.
You know, it's burned onto our brain, isn't it? It's, yeah, it's one of those things that you can't unsee. Yeah.
You can't unsee.
We all remember where we were that day as well.
Yeah, we do. Did you ever go to the Twin Towers? Did you go to the Windows on the World?
Loads of times, yeah. I went back, took the kids up there. You could go up to the second tower, and there was a kind of place, a viewing platform where you could go outside the top of the building and watch planes coming into land.
Yes, I know. It was
down on the planes. I took all the kids up there. I've still got the tickets.
Yeah, absolutely. In old-fashioned terms, which, of course, I wouldn't dare dreaming of using these days, it was a real bird puller to invite a girl to come and join me for dinner at the Windows on the World when I was living in New York.
Oh, God. What can you say, really?
Well, it's
all about pulling women, isn't it?
No. Come on. I said I wouldn't use it these days. Remember, I was a younger man.
You just did.
No. I was a younger man. I was impressionable, okay, you know, and I thought this will look good. And, you know, can you imagine living in Manhattan in your sort of mid to late 20s and being able to jump into a yellow cab, surge off downtown with a young lady next to you and say, yeah, we're going to the Windows on the World. What? You know, it was a great thing to be able to do. And I have to admit, I did exploit that ability.
But
that doesn't make me a bad person. Doesn't make me a bad person.
Maybe a few things have redeemed you since.
Maybe they have. Talking about a bad person, right? And this is only my personal opinion. I note this week reading a story about Jon Snow, the news presenter, at the age of 73, is becoming a father again. And I have two observations on this. One, I don't really very much like Jon Snow, which I'll tell you about in a minute. But two, and we, you know, the debate has happened before with men of that sort of age. Is it wise for a man of 73 to have a new child?
Well, did anybody say that to Mick Jagger?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think I did.
You know, it's all right for men. They can carry on having babies right up until the week they die.
Yeah.
There is no male menopause. I know people like to say, oh, you know, men go through this male menopause. That's psychological. That isn't hormonal, where your reproductive system packs up at a certain stage in your life. Men physically, biologically, can go on fathering children until they die.
Yeah.
And this is what's happened here. But the baby has been born by a surrogate.
Yes,
because
that's right.
His partner is 46, and technically you can, as a woman, still give birth at the age of 46.
Yeah.
You still can bring a baby to term.
Yeah.
But they have, I understood, a series of medical setbacks. They had a few miscarriages, and they decided in the end to use a surrogate. Yeah. So I don't see why not. You know, 73 is not old these days.
Well,
but why don't you like him anyway?
The reason I don't like him is because whenever I've run into him, I've always found him pompous, supercilious, arrogant, domineering, and rather full of himself. We went to Bermuda once because it was a shocking story. It was one of these tall mast races, you know? You know, there's these sort of tall mast ships, which are...
Tall ships races,
that's right. And a lot of them are used to help underprivileged youngsters, you know, to find a discipline in life, you know, and to give them a sense of adventure and all that kind of stuff. And one of those was cruising towards America off Bermuda, and it went down in the Bermuda Triangle because a wind of about 90 miles an hour suddenly whipped up behind the ship. And it filled the sails before they could get the sails down. And it had the effect of tipping the ship forward up from the back and straight down into the sea like a submarine. And everybody was lost on board. You know what I mean? They never recovered a body or anything. And that happened off Bermuda. So we all troop out to Bermuda, you know, all dashed off to the, you know, LaGuardia Airport and got whatever next flight you could and got there. I got there real early. And, you know, got all the story wrapped up and everything. And after the sort of 36 hours of the story, you know, being done over 2 days, we then go into this hotel and we're having a couple of sherbets. And Jon Snow is holding court with his ITV crew just across the lounge from us. But, I mean, so full of it about how well he'd done and, you know, he cracked this and he cracked that, wiped the BBC off the face of the earth. And then a waiter comes up and says, oh, is there a Mr. Snow here? He said, yeah, that's me. The telephone for you, sir. There were no mobile phones in those days, believe it or not. And he says, oh, what do they want now? You know, like it was a real pain, you know. And he goes sloping off. He's about 6'4". Anyway, a few minutes later, he comes back, says, don't worry, fellas, just the herogram for me. And then walked back to his table and sat down, you know. But on another occasion, he was doing the US election tour that I was doing with Bill Clinton. And my phone rang in my hotel room in somewhere. I don't know where the hell we were, you know, like Dakota or somewhere. And I picked it up and I said, yeah, hello. And this voice said, hi, Harry. Great to see you, mate. You know, haven't seen you for years. I'm down in the bar. Come down and join me and we'll have a drink. And I said, sorry, this is not Harry. He said, who's that? I said, it's Mike Parry from the Daily Express. He said, oh. I said, who are you? He said, this is John Snow from ITN. I said, oh, okay, John. I said, well, it's nice to know you're in town. I tell you what, I'll come down and buy you a drink. No, don't bother. Thank you. Bang.
Oh, well. See, yeah. You see, you're suffering from this sort of snub syndrome.
I am suffering from the snub syndrome.
Yeah, well, as you described Piers being a bit cross with Meghan for having dropped him once she met Prince Harry.
Yeah.
The same thing has happened to you with Jon Snow.
Oh, yeah, but his attitude was just, I don't mix with tabloid journalists. Don't you see? I'm a proper broadcasting journalist, you know. Well, bollocks to that. And on another occasion,
You've taken this far too personally.
No. On another occasion, and this wasn't me, it was a colleague on the Express, the story broke that he was supposed to be romancing Anna Ford, okay?
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, in those days, again, he was an ITN reporter, but for some unknown reason, he lived with a housemate in some house in Fulham or something like that. You know what I mean? I suppose I never want to live with a housemate, but I suppose people do. And so our reporter goes around, a bloke called Colin Bell, and knocked on the door, and his housemate opened the door, and he said, yes. And Colin explained, you know, I'm Colin Bell, Daily Express, you know, we're all mates together in the world of journalism. He was Scottish, by the way. And
I was wondering when he moved to Pakistan.
Oh, no, come on, you know. And explained. So this guy shouts, John, and his voice said, yes. Chap in the Daily Express wants to talk to you about Anna. And all he heard back was, well, tell him to piss off. I don't talk to the newspapers. I mean, it was pathetic considering we're all in the same blinking business, you know?
Rule number one, really, you don't kind of mess with journalists, do you?
Sure.
I mean, you know, you kind of have to do a Piers, be back at him again.
Yeah.
But you have to be nice about it, even if you're not going to say anything.
Yeah.
You have to come to the door. You have to say, thank you very much for coming around. I've really got nothing to say. I'm sure you can understand. But, you know, sorry, guys, it's no comment. But see you on the next job or something like that.
I would do what any decent person would do and say, look, I can't invite you all in, but I'll go and get you a couple of bottles of beer and bring them out, you know. And if I was the centre of attention, I'd make sure they were all looked after. But
Well, no, you couldn't do that because you know what it's like with a features editor or a news editor.
Yeah.
If you have a drink with the guy, you've got a double-page spread.
Yeah.
If he says three things, you know, you've got an exclusive interview. So they've got to be very careful. And he would be well aware of all the techniques being deployed to try and get a story out of him. So I can kind of see why he didn't want to talk to anyone, but you do have to be nice about it.
Yeah. And then recently, about a couple of years ago, because he's very left wing, so he attacks anybody who's right wing. And Nigel Lawson, the former Chancellor, was writing a piece about the Brexit deal, which he was in support of, you know. And Jon Snow trashed this in a tweet by saying, so here's the former Chancellor, Nigel Lawson, you know, writing in support of Brexit from his second home in France. You couldn't make it up. And in fact, Nigel Lawson lived in France, and Dominic Lawson pointed out in his column, my father only got one home, and that's in France. I do hope Mr. Snow will apologise for trying to make out my father is living between two homes. But, of course, the apology never came. I might be getting a bit obsessed by Jon Snow, really.
Well, you don't know that. You actually don't know. I have to point this out, Michael.
Point
you don't know that the apology never came. Perhaps there was a private one.
There could have been a private one, but Dominic Lawson, his son, asked for it to be put in writing as the first one had been, and to my knowledge, it never came. If it did go, John, and you're a decent chap, then you have my full apologies. But I think
let it go, Mike.
Is right. Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky, myself, the Porkmeister, and of course, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, the rock chick writer extraordinaire. Do you know anything, Leslie Ann? Although I think it's probably, I don't think it is of your genre, the singer Nina Cherry. Is 57 today, And did she make that song Buffalo something?
Yeah, Buffalo Stance, yeah. She's actually Nana Cherry. Most people mispronounce her name. She's Swedish-born, by the way.
Oh,
I don't know if you knew that.
No, I didn't. I thought she was Caribbean, actually.
No. Her name originally was Nana Carlson. Oh. And she changed it in the 1980s. She was quite big on the punk, post-punk scene in London. She was one of the Slits. She was in Rip Riggum Panic.
Yeah.
And I suppose the songs we remember most of hers, 7 Seconds, Buffalo Stance, as you mentioned, Manchild, Kisses on the Wind.
So she's quite successful, was she?
Oh, very successful, yeah. She's a really lovely girl.
Really? Have you met her?
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. So
time ago. I haven't seen her for years. But
no, exactly.
Yeah, she was very pleasant back in the day, yeah.
I was going to say, do you have nice experiences with her when you're interviewing her?
Nice memories. She was just a nice, low-key person who, you know, she never bigged herself up or anything like that.
Really?
Just a proper musician, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You've been in more sort of rock star dressing rooms, and I don't mean that with any underhanded insinuations, Miss Jones.
I very well hope not.
Of course not. But, you, I mean, for instance, you know, you went backstage at Band Aid. You even drove there in one of the stars' Rolls Royces and all that. So very close. So I read this story. Oasis once played for a hot meal. They have sold millions of records around the world and won numerous awards, but life has not always been glitz and glamour for Oasis. What's happened is somebody's selling off one of those orders that you put in, you know, the band puts in for the dressing room, you know, 10 cans of lager and all that kind of stuff.
It's called a contract rider.
Well done.
Yeah, these are all the conditions little sort of perks, I suppose you'd call them, that the artist or the band require of each venue to put in their dressing room or to have made available to them.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And there've been some real odd ones over the years, haven't there, where one particular member of a band wanted all one colour of sweets taken out of the bowl of M&Ms and all this kind of nonsense.
The orange ones.
Was it the orange ones? Yeah, that's right.
Why do you say nonsense? Because you have your preferences of things that you will eat and drink or use.
Yeah.
So why is that nonsense?
Yeah. Well, I just think it's so petty to say I want, you know, a big bowl of M&M, but please take all the orange ones out. I mean, that's, you know, that's just...
Well, if that artist had an allergy to something in the chemical that makes the orange colour?
Couldn't be any different to the whatever was in the other colours, you know. But if it was an allergy to nuts, well, you know, I could understand, but not to the colour orange. I don't believe it. But anyway,
well, what about this? And it's not just rock stars, right? Because Liz Taylor always demanded that her dressing room was painted pink before she arrived at any theatre.
Yes.
And she had to have 50 brand new white towels in the dressing room as well. 50 brand new white towels, yeah. So it's not just rock stars. I think we ought to get away from beating up rock stars here a little bit.
Well, I actually had an experience like this as well. We didn't call it the contract rider. It was always whenever we were booked for a theatre, we were doing, a show on the road. We went all over the country and Newcastle and Cardiff and Birmingham. And we ended up in New York, actually, not very far from the biggest venue in New York, where they have the boxing matches that you don't
use. Madison Square Garden.
Madison Square Garden. We ended up in a venue just a few doors away from Madison Square Garden. But it was never called the contract rider. It was always, what do you want in the dressing room, you know? And we would always have, I don't know, 4 bottles of Pinot and, some water. We never asked for food because I can't eat before I talk. I don't know why, it just affects me. So I never wanted any food or anything like that. But, you know, you could ask for anything you wanted, really. But, of course, the trick is that at our level, that was all taken off your fee anyway. You know what I mean? It wasn't like, you know, the Rolling Stones get it for free, but we didn't get anything for free. But the funniest story was we did a show in Liverpool at the O2 Arena in Liverpool, okay? And we booked all this by emails and all that again. We've been asked to go and do it, and we'd agreed the fee and all that. And then what do you want in your dressing room? So we got there. There were our usual bottles of Pinot, and I think the other guy had asked for a bottle of whiskey, Jack Daniels or something like that, for the after show or something like that, you know. And there were these 2 bottles of red wine. So the promoter, a guy called, what's his name now? I think it was Pat or something like that. He was a scouser. And he came in about an hour before the show and said, "All right, lads, how are you?" I said, "Yeah, fine, thank you, yeah. great. He says, everything all right in here? Everything that you wanted? You got everything you want? Yeah, that's great. Yeah. I said, yeah. I said, by the way, I said, you know, we wanted the Pinot, we wanted the Jack Daniels, and thank you for the snacks and all that kind of stuff, but we didn't actually order two bottles of red. All right, I'll help you out with that then. So he opened them both and then drunk them both before the show, right, and then disappeared. And, of course, they appeared on our bill.
Well, that's hilarious. But, you know, he's done it before, hasn't he? Yeah. He obviously ordered them so that they would be there for him to drink.
That's exactly right. He just, you know, they were twist-cap bottles. He's, oh, I'll help you with that, lad. Don't worry, we'll get rid of them for you. And then he just drunk them. And I thought...
That's the perk of the job, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't want to say anything. Listen, I don't know about you, but the happiest story of the week for me was the little penguin who leapt out of the ocean into a tourist boat when he was being chased by an orca whale who was going to have him for dinner. Did you see it?
I did see it. It wasn't just an orca whale. It won. It was a whole pod of killer whales.
Yes.
This was in Antarctica, wasn't it?
Yes.
There's all these tourists cruising the icebergs in the chilly, glistening blue paradise of Antarctica. Yeah. And suddenly in hops a penguin because he's about to be lunch for one of these killer whales.
I know.
Again, too, penguin. Apparently, not that I know one penguin from the next, really, but killer whales do eat penguins, and that is the circle of life. Yeah. So what happened to him after that? He hopped back into the water.
Yeah.
Maybe he did at a later stage become afternoon tea to the killer whale, but very cute story.
Oh, incredibly cute. A poor little penguin. I'd have been frightened to have let him go back in the sea because you'd have thought, well, they're going to get you one of these days, mate. You know what I mean? But definitely. I didn't know penguins went that far out anyway, did you? I thought they just flapped around on the, you know, on the sort of pebble beach shore type thing.
Well, they go from iceberg to iceberg, don't they? You see all those wonderful wildlife programs that David Attenborough makes.
Yeah, but they usually march, don't they? Yeah, I only ever see penguins marching.
Well, they swim, don't forget.
All right, okay, if you say so.
Yeah, they do. Of course they do. You've seen footage of them swimming.
I suppose
penguins.
I have.
They don't just hop around.
Yeah, usually only in zoos you see them swimming, I think. And I don't think they should be... I don't think they should be kept in zoos anyway. Miss Jones, we've talked before about Tom Jones and Mary Wilson, but I saw an extraordinary interview with him in one of the, what we call the heavy papers, the review section. And he says, you know, my relationship with Mary Wilson wasn't a fling. It went on for 5 years. On the very next page, and you turn over, there's a picture of Tom posing with his ever-suffering wife. And, you know, I know his wife's not alive now, but she must have known about the 5-year relationship. We've talked about this before, but what an extraordinary relationship they must have had. And he goes on about, you know, well, you know, I love my wife so much and all that kind of stuff. The show business world told me I was too macho and I had to turn it all down. But he says it without a word of shame.
Well, he's in his 80s. You know, he's in the last phase of his life. He's got nothing to lose.
Yeah, it's true.
I'm a big fan of Tom Jones, but I've always balked at that kind of confession. You know, they were married. He and Linda were married 59 years. They were together from when they were 16. Yeah. She was pregnant when they got married.
Yeah.
And so they're together 59 years. At one point, he's confessed this. He was having sex with up to 250 groupies a year. So it wasn't just long-term relationships with women like Mary Wilson.
Yeah.
It was all the one-night stands as well. And Linda did used to complain. She did attack him physically once or twice.
Yeah.
But they were joined at the hip for life and she wasn't going to leave him. And he took advantage of that. I think no woman today would put up with that. If you want to go out there putting it around, you know, off you go, divorce court. Yes. There was also another thing which left a nasty taste, really. His illegitimate son. So he had a one-night stand, right. Resulted in a pregnancy. Tom Jones denied it. Eventually, after the DNA test came back positive, he did admit it.
Right.
But he refused to meet this poor guy, a guy called Jonathan Berkery,
right.
Who has talked to the papers a few times over the years.
Yeah.
And he's the dead spit of Tom Jones. You can tell it's his son. Right. But Tom Jones has shown no interest in meeting him. And I think that's very cruel.
Yeah. Has that been for life now?
What do you mean?
Has he ever met him? Or are you,
no, he's they've never, ever met.
Never met, and no.
All Jonathan ever wanted, he said, I don't want his money. No. I don't want, you know, but I just want to meet my father. And of course, that's going to screw somebody up for life, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Denies you and says, oh, all right, yes, I admit I'm your dad, but I don't want anything to do with you.
No, I totally agree. Let me, you just mentioned divorce settlement there, right? So I'm telling you now that the luckiest man in the world is now a guy called Mackenzie Scott, all right? Because Mackenzie Scott, who is a teacher, has met and is now engaged to the lady who is the ex-wife of Jeff Bezos, the man who runs Amazon and is sometimes the richest man in the world, depending on his share price value. And this lady, the guy, by the way, his name is Dan Jewett, but the lady concerned, hang on, I've got this wrong. The lady is called Mackenzie Scott. I'm going mad.
I was going to say, you are going mad because her name is Mackenzie, right?
Yeah, her name is Mackenzie Scott. The chap is Dan Jewett. He's a teacher. Mackenzie Scott was left $38 billion, not left.
No.
Handed
she
over.
Was not
handed
left.
Over.
No. Yeah?
Well, she's got $38 billion, put it that way.
Well, go back. So Jeff Bezos didn't give her the money. He acknowledged her equal share in building that business that led to all that wealth being made.
Yeah, except that.
So he didn't give it to her.
She's got it. That's what I'm saying.
She has that amount of money. But so what? If she loves the guy and if he loves her, what's money got to do with it?
Well, you can never tell. That's the problem. When you're that wealthy, you live in a completely unreal world. How are you ever going to tell?
I suppose. I mean, look, if you take need out of the equation, which is why people work, to earn money, to pay the bills, put the roof over their heads, so to cover all their needs.
Yeah.
If there are no needs, then you're at liberty to fall in love with somebody for the right reasons.
Yeah. I always wonder how J.K. Rowling's husband copes, because she's like a billionaire now, and she's probably, you know, the richest self-made woman in the world, apart from Ms. Scott Mackenzie here, obviously. And I just wonder how you do it, because I think he's a doctor, J.K. Rowling.
He is a doctor, so he's not somebody who cares about money. So set the money aside, you know. Yeah. Guess what, love? We're never going to have to worry about paying the gas bill or buying the groceries or keeping a roof over our head.
Yeah.
So we are at liberty to explore a relationship for a real reason.
Yes.
I think that is the ultimate luxury.
Well, yeah, I suppose it is. But you know how I am in life, Miss Jones. You know me long enough. I've never allowed a woman even to buy me a drink, ever. I don't think
you
I've ever...
You let me buy you a drink?
I don't think I have. Have I?
Have I?
Have I? Well,
but
all right.
Well, it's different. We're not romantically entwined.
No, we're not romantically entwined. And sometimes it may be because I've bought three drinks and you've insisted that you're going to get the next one or something like that. You know, although I
pay my way. I've always done so.
I'll put it on the record. You always insist on buying round for round. But I can't stand that when I'm out with any woman, whether I'm romantically involved or not. And we're not, obviously. I just feel uncomfortable. So how on earth J.K. Rowling's husband feels about, well, I tell you what, we'll just take off to the Caribbean for 3 weeks. We'll hire, you know, a villa at 6,000 a night, and we'll throw in a boat at 10,000 a day to go out on a few trips. I mean, I couldn't handle that. I'd feel like a kept man. Does that make me a bad person?
Not at all, no. But I suppose she's going, look, I'll buy the houses, you get the gin and tonics. You know, it doesn't really mean anything, does it? Money is of no consequence because they have more than enough of it.
Well, they've got more than they could ever spend. But listen, going to the other end of the scale, and this story really sent a shiver down my back. Unemployed Oxford graduate Fayaz Siddiqui, age 41, who is living for free in his parents' £1.5 million flat, and is given £400 a week pocket money by them, is suing the parents to force them to pay him child maintenance for life. I mean,
it's
what
a very interesting story, this, because this is like a watershed case, isn't it? This could affect the rights of all parents in the UK going forward, because he's claiming violation of his human rights. And he could, technically, I've been thinking this one through.
Yes.
If you're his lawyer... Say you're his barrister, you could come forward and argue. This guy never asked to be born. He has health issues. He's an Oxford graduate, by the way, a trained lawyer. He's the guy who sued Oxford University. Do you remember?
And he wanted a first-class degree, didn't he?
He sued them for inadequate teaching. Yes. The case was rejected, and he didn't get anywhere. But he was trying to get into Harvard or somewhere, and they rejected him. So he tried to sue Oxford. But now he's very clever. Obviously, he's worked all this out.
Yeah.
That he could technically sue his parents on the basis that he never asked to be born. So therefore, if they wanted the child, they should support him for the rest of his life. It'd be very interesting to see where this one goes.
But I mean, just the emotional sort of relationship now between parent and child, that's what really gets me. I think, you know, that's never going to be a family again. There's never going to be paternal and maternal and you know, love for your child and all that. It just makes me shiver a bit. Tell me, Ms. Jones, you've met most people in this world, and I'm so envious of you for all the famous people you have met. Have you ever met Sharon Stone?
No, I never have. No, film stars weren't really my thing.
No, they weren't.
You know, I was more into covering music.
Yes, I know.
She's an interesting person-ish, isn't she? I mean, look, she did Basic Instinct, what, she was about 33, 34 in that film, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
And it turned her into a sex symbol. Who wants to be that in the modern world?
Yeah.
She's not remembered for anything else other than flashing her Fandango on the screen.
Oh, no, Miss Jones, come on. You know, I keep having to remind you of the Family Show. That's absolutely. Well, I think that's a bit unfair. But you're true. Whenever anybody refers to Sharon Stone, that's the scene that they refer to. And you're quite right. And the only reason I asked you was because I saw a picture of her the other day. She's 63, but she still looks 33, if you know what I mean.
They have all the work, don't they?
Well, yes.
She's had a few pricks in her face, let's say.
Oh, now, Miss Jones, come on, you know, there's innuendo and pure blatant filth, you know, and I think you're heading...
Innuendo is an Italian suppository, as we all know.
As we all know. What about Billie Piper? You must have met her.
I can't remember.
Really?
I have.
But,
I might have been at a party with her when she was with Chris Evans.
Oh, that's right,
a long time ago.
Yeah, I saw a picture of her again saying, "Why I Went Wild in My 20s by Billie Piper." Well,
who didn't?
Yeah, I was going to say, we all did.
Tell us something we don't know, because weren't we all going wild in our 20s?
Exactly. Listen, are you aware, and this is coming right out of left wing, are you aware of Peter O'Toole once having performed as Macbeth, and it almost destroyed his career because it was so bad?
No.
Oh, okay. This
must have been before I was born.
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree. And he's been dead a number of years now. But again, I just saw this feature in one of the heavy arts pages, you know, and it was trying to make out why Peter O'Toole nearly tried to destroy his career by performing the worst Macbeth in the history of the theatre, okay? Behind the scenes of the car crash Macbeth that stalked the star to his grave and why he did it. The only reason I mention it is because I was a very young reporter in London at the time. I wasn't even working for the Express. I was working for the Birmingham Evening Mail. And I was told to go along and review this play at the Old Vic. And it was truly appalling. But unfortunately, I didn't know anything about Shakespeare because I hadn't bothered studying it properly at school because I thought Shakespeare was very boring, you know. And so I wrote a review for the following day's evening paper, you know, that night, which said it was brilliant and it was, you know, dramatic and, you know, so impactful. And I filed that night. So they all got up the next morning in Birmingham and read its review, put it in the paper, only then for the later editions of the national newspapers, which, of course, don't appear in Birmingham. You see what I mean? The later editions are just in London. Absolutely slagging and slating O'Toole as the worst Shakespearean performance they've ever seen. And I became a kind of media celebrity for seeing only good in this performance, which apparently was one of the worst ever. But I couldn't talk to anybody else about it because I didn't know what I was talking about.
Yeah, but you had an opinion. So you expressed your opinion. Doesn't matter if it differed from everybody else's, because you obviously saw something shining out of the sky that brought Shakespeare to life in a way that they couldn't perceive.
Yeah, but the problem was I didn't realise...
You believe that old rubbish, you believe anything.
Yeah, exactly. But the thing is, I didn't realise that he'd got all the words wrong. You know what I mean? I mean, he'd got all the dialogue wrong.
So his interpretation was more elaborate than that was generally known.
You could
have turned a phrase for any of that, couldn't you, really?
Yeah, but I didn't realise.
You're a very clever writer.
Yeah, but these theatre critics who know what they're talking about realise that in a part of Macbeth, when he should have been weeping and crying and mourning the dead, he was laughing hysterically on his back and waving his legs around and all this kind of stuff.
He was probably pissed. He was known for that, wasn't he?
He probably was pissed, yeah. but anyway, it meant that they sent me back to the theatre the following night and demanded funny. I get an interview with Peter O'Toole.
Did you get it?
Of course not, because he told me to F off, literally, you know. And even though I tried to sell myself at the stage door by saying, hang on, I'm the only journalist who wrote a favourable review. Tell him I'm his hero. And it still came back. No, sorry, that's mate, F funny. Off. And that was it.
So he was being a bit of an O'Toole on that occasion, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was being a bit of an O'Toole. You're absolutely right. But anyway, there we go. Listen, just one final line, because we have to treat the serious with the lighthearted. How about this as a headline? How corona may trigger diseases from diabetes to MS and damage the brain too. It's not just long COVID. Now experts are warning the virus may also cause a range of serious illnesses for years to come. You have been warning about this, Miss Jones. I have to give you credit for that.
Well, look, they're still finding out about it, aren't they? And they know nothing. All the different side effects, all the reactions that people are getting. Everybody's supposed to report those, by the way, on the NHS website.
Yeah.
So there's a huge variety of reactions that people have to the vaccine now, mm-hmm. which everyone's supposed to go on and fill in the form. I think very few people are doing it.
Yeah.
But it's important to let the NHS know what kind of side effects people are experiencing, because they will ultimately be able to piece together a profile of, you know, what this virus is actually doing, what the vaccine can do to combat it.
Yep.
And eventually they'll get on top of it, so that there will be some sort of medical intervention, like whether it's a nasal spray, an eye drop, and another injection, whatever we can take to protect ourselves from this. But look how very long it took to get to that stage with HIV treatments.
Yes. Yes, no.
So we're with this for a long, long time. Yeah,
no, I totally accept that, and you're absolutely right. Right, OK, folks, well, that's it for another episode from Life on Planet Porky. Ms. Jones, I hope you have a fruitful couple of days between now and when we talk next. As I say, the blustery winds have caused a bit of a problem out in the garden. I'm now going out to fix up the furniture. And Ms. Jones, all I can say is stay safe, as I would urge our millions of listeners to also take care and stay safe.
Stay safe, everyone. Don't blow away. No umbrellas, no Mary Poppins.
In old-fashioned terms, which, of course, I wouldn't dare dream of using these days, it was a real bird puller to invite a girl to come and join me for dinner at the Windows on the World when I was living in New York.
Oh, God, I mean, what can you say, really?
Well, it's
all about pulling women, isn't it?
No, come on. I said I wouldn't use it these days. Remember, I was a younger man.
You just did.
No. I was a younger man. I was impressionable, okay, you know, and I thought this will look good. And, you know, can you imagine living in Manhattan in your sort of mid to late 20s and being able to jump into a yellow cab, surge off downtown with a young lady next to you and say, yeah, we're going to the Windows on the World. What? You know, it was a great thing to be able to do. And I have to admit, I did exploit that ability.
She's not remembered for anything else other than flashing her Fandango on the screen.
Oh, no, Miss Jones, come on. You know, I keep reminding you of the family show. That's absolutely. Well, I think that's a bit unfair. But you're true. Whenever anybody refers to Sharon Stone, that's the scene that they refer to. And you're quite right. And the only reason I asked you was because I saw a picture of her the other day. She's 63, but she still looks 33, if you know what I mean.
They have all the work, don't they?
Well, yes.
She's had a few pricks in her face, let's say.
Oh, now, Miss Jones, come on, you know.
Did you get it?
Of course not, because he told me to F off, literally, you know.